Today on MainCon, the social contract. What do we owe to each other? It's an age-old philosophical and political question. What should we expect from our government and from each other? I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll discuss what's meant by a social contract and how it applies to the modern debate over the role of government, the responsibilities of citizens, the protection of rights and freedoms, and the need to keep order. It's at the center of so many front-burner issues: economic disparity, homelessness, education, healthcare, and preserving democracy. A panel of scholars will weigh in, and as always, we want to hear from you. The social contract. Are we all really in this together? Main Calling is coming up.
Main Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. It's a philosophical question that's been around for a long time. What do we as individuals owe, if anything, to our fellow citizens? Are we really in this all together? That's what we'll be discussing on today's show, and we hope to have you share your thoughts on the question. Joining me are three college professors who have thought and written about the social contract. Lydia Moland is the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Professor of Philosophy at Colby College. She's the author of Lydia Maria Child, A Radical American Life. Paul Schofield is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Bates College, and Rob Glover is an Associate Professor of Political Science and Honors, as well as co-leader of the Scholars Strategy Network, the Maine chapter, at the University of Maine. And we invite you, as always, to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. So, social contract theory. I'm going to give the layman's my layman's impression, and then you can brutally redirect me. It's the idea that as members of a society, we agree to surrender some of our freedoms and submit to some type of authority in exchange for civil order. So, in other words, I, citizen, agree to pay taxes and follow the law. If you, government, can make sure that there are working sewers and Canada doesn't invade, or at the very least, my neighbor doesn't steal my cow. Rob, is that in the ballpark?
Yeah, I think it is, Keith. It's generally a conceptualization of some sort of liberty given in exchange for some sort of goods from the government. And the idea is that we leave a state of nature, which would be the period before the existence of civil government, and enter into some sort of more organized society, but we derive certain benefits from that.
Yeah. Lydia?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a wonderful way to phrase it. And I think I would just start off by talking briefly about one of the great founders of this tradition, who would be Thomas Hobbes, writing in the aftermath of the English Civil War, who conceptualized something that he called the state of nature, in which he envisioned what humans would be like if there were no government controlling them. And as many of your listeners will know, it is not a pretty picture. He imagines that humans are fundamentally self-interested, interested primarily in their own self-preservation, and that they'll do anything in that interest. And that they're actually also allowed to do that, that we have a natural right to do whatever we need to do in the interest of our self-preservation. And so this is where the famous Hobbesian phrase, life is nasty, poor, rudish, and short, comes from. The only good news in that phrase is that it's short. So when humans are just left to their own devices without a government, they tend to be very violent in ways that create a kind of chaos. But luckily for us, that chaos will end quickly because we'll probably be killed. So Hobbes' idea was that we needed to lay down some of our natural rights to self-preservation to a sovereign who would then enforce the contract that we made with each other to lay down those rights. And the other thing I'll just say briefly is that the vision of human nature that that brings across is a very dark one. And I think it's important for us to realize that the story that we tell ourselves about what humans are like informs the way we treat each other. So if you believe Hobbes that humans are naturally this way and that it's only a government keeping us from killing each other, essentially, you're going to treat others with suspicion. They are then likely to treat you with suspicion and a whole sort of cycle of that kind of attitude towards each other as citizens can really take a pretty pernicious hold.
And we should say that this thinking had been going on, since the Greeks for centuries and centuries. But the era that we're talking about now is the Age of Enlightenment. This is when Hobbes comes along, and there are a couple of other thinkers that we'll discuss here who kind of belong on, I guess, the Mount Rushmore of social contract theory. So Hobbes is the Hobbes believes, as you're explaining, in he favors like a powerful sovereign, like a powerful authority figure, as needed to counter the natural brutishness of humans.
Yes, and he's willing to say that once that sovereign is in power, since the main evil that we are trying to protect ourselves from is civil war, then whatever that sovereign needs to do to prevent that counts as justice. So the sovereign is really allowed to define what justice is. And then Hobbes says that the end of obedience is protection. The reason that you should obey the government is because it protects you. And if you find yourself in a position where the government can or will no longer protect you, then your duty of obedience to the government is also at an end.
So then we have John Locke, Rob, who takes a different view. I had read he's considered the father of liberalism, although not the liberalism that we discuss today. Tell us about him and how he compares to Hobbes.
Sure. So Locke is considerably less pessimistic than Hobbes, right? So he's operating with the same basic framework. He's thinking about what life would be like in the state of nature before the existence of government. And he doesn't think it would be a war of all against all, which is another term that Hobbes uses. He says it would be an ill condition not to be endured. Basically, it would be an inconvenient place in which to exist, in which all of the things that we take for granted today from government, establishing the law, enforcing the law, making judgments about the law, we would need to do individually. And that's not only cumbersome, but it's also problematic in that there can be bias if we're administering justice on our own behalf. So it's important to note that both Locke and Hobbes are writing in the context of extraordinary political turmoil and conflict within their own societies and within Europe. And that shapes the way certainly Hobbes is going to think about this, but also Locke as well. And he actually had to flee England to Holland for 7 years because of some of his controversial ideas. But his basic argument is that we would leave the state of nature and we would seek government to protect our natural rights, which again, he defines more expansively than Hobbes. It's not just about life and self-preservation. It's also about liberty, a space in which we can make choices and have some autonomy over our own lives. And property is going to be really important for Locke. And arguably, I think Locke probably has the greatest influence on the founders of our institutions here in the United States. The founders were very much, I mean, at points almost kind of plagiarizing from certain elements of Locke's second treatise as they were writing about the institutions that should eventually replace, our colonial administration from the British at the point of the American founding. So he's considerably more optimistic and views things less pessimistically than Hobbes does.
And then Paul, enter Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who I guess expands the social contract theory, suggesting what that it's more of a balance between personal freedom balanced by collective ethics, or how would you characterize, I guess, what he brings to the table and why he's the third voice, the third thinker we're talking about today?
Yeah, well, if we see this as some kind of progress from Hobbes through Locke to Rousseau, I think Rousseau is considerably more optimistic about human nature. He thinks that before we had society, we were in certain ways better off. I mean, we got along pretty well, but then once we began coming into contact with one another for long periods of time, we began comparing ourselves to one another and wanting to look good in others' eyes and get their attention and regard. And so this ends up creating a lot of conflict and difficulty, because obviously not everyone can be the star, right? Not everyone can be the one who has the most esteem. And so his insight, I think, is that when we have this part of ourselves that that seeks esteem, but we have another part of ourselves, which he calls the general will, which takes into account other people's points of view and other people's interests. So we actually, in some ways, have a desire or a drive to recognize other people's points of view also. So he thinks that when we contract into society, we are attempting to create a society in which this general will is kind of realized, where everybody counts for something, where everybody's interests and everybody's views are taken into account. I think the important thing that he points out is that once we all come together, he imagines that we have a kind of democracy where everybody gets a vote, but we're not supposed to vote just for whatever it is that is in our own interest or our own want. We vote the general will. So if we think, you know, sometimes I think in the US, we think of voting as just like, well, I want to get my piece. You know, I want my piece of the pie. I want to help myself out. But that's not really what Rousseau suggests. He suggests that what we're supposed to be voting for is a kind of, a set of policies that would be able to be endorsed from every point of view. And I think that's sort of what he adds to the picture.
Let's bring it then to the present. It's all really fascinating stuff and very heady, but let's use it to, I guess, translate some of the tensions that we see in our lives today. I think first, I guess, to politics and what we consider liberals versus conservatives, views of government and that sort of thing, Lydia, where, you know, historically liberals those that believe that government is there to serve, that government is good, that it protects people, that it protects those of lesser means, versus the sort of conservative view that limited government is best, and that we need to give individuals freedom and power to do well for themselves. I'm just sort of, it's overly simplified there. But how does that, first of all, do you agree with my assessment there, and how does that fit into or is informed by some of the ideas that we just discussed?
Well, I think I'll take the opportunity of that question just to pivot a little bit and talk about someone who's not usually in this conversation. And I should say, too, that during the period that Locke and Rousseau and Hobbes were philosophizing, there were also women philosophizing about social contract, including people like Margaret Cavendish and Mary Astell. And they were making the point that women are often left out of the social contract. And people went on then to say that there were also many other people, notably people being either enslaved or colonized, or in the case of North America, indigenous peoples whose natural rights were being trampled on. And in that context, I think about someone that I've written about, Lydia Maria Child, who was an abolitionist, so someone not allowed to be a professional philosopher, but who did a lot of philosophizing in trying to decide how to convince her fellow Americans to think about what it meant to be in the social contract, including such people. And one of the insights I really take from her is that when we talk about Americans having an inalienable, or people having an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that can be read in a very individualistic way. But it can also be read, and this is connecting to something that you just said, in a way that says part of our obligation as part of this social contract is to make sure that other people's life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is not only guaranteed, but given the material conditions for success. So we can't just connect to these things abstractly and say, well, now formerly enslaved people are emancipated. We also, as white Americans, she would say, need to lean into what else they need in order to function fully in this society. And that's part of what we are obligated to do as part of this social contract.
So there's part of this is what you're saying is we have an obligation to do this because it's the right thing. But on the other side, a lot of this is about what's my motivation? Like, what's in it for me, even if I'm choosing to do these things for the good of the many, there must be something in it for me. And anyone from the group can respond to that.
I can hop in on that. So, you know, from Locke's perspective, really, like, existing outside of an organized society and without the protection of civil government is, you know, it's kind of a barren existence. There's lots of things that require shared effort and kind of a collective sense of what we owe to one another. And civil government can be an excellent arbiter for what those, for kind of enabling people to achieve those things in concert with one another. It's very hard to do that in, you know, a scattered, less centralized way. But it's interesting, too, because within this tradition, there's a fear of centralized power. So in a lot of ways, like, Locke introduces democratic institutions because at the same time that he recognizes the need for a strong central government to guarantee those basic rights, he's fearful of the power that's being lodged within a centralized authority. And I think that theme, you know, that tension between we recognize the need for government, but we're also terribly fearful of centralized power. That goes back to, you know, our founding as a country and also deeply informs American culture. So I think that these thinkers, though they were writing in the 17th century, have hit upon some themes that continue to drive debates that we see today. And some of the challenges that we face right now as a society and as a country are emerging out of things that they were talking about hundreds of years ago.
It seems when you get to, if you look at these seemingly separate debates about these front burner issues like public education or healthcare or social security or tax policy, it really comes down to your belief about personal responsibility versus the what we owe to the collective group. I'm sort of simplifying it, I guess, but and it comes down to the tension between those. It's not that we ever reach one belief or the other. It's a constant tension that sort of describes our way of life, our culture, our political being.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think another way to think about this too is we can compare the different thinkers in terms of how preoccupied they are with the thought that an individual should be trying to benefit themselves when they step into the ballot box or do anything in politics. So you might think, well, everybody's sort of in this for themselves. Everybody wants to benefit themselves. And the reason why you need a contract is because we would have chaos without a contract. And so everybody's just trying to benefit themselves by making an agreement with others. But there's an alternative. So, I mean, that would have been sort of the Hobbes view. But the alternative is the thought that each of us actually wants what we do to be justifiable to other people. That's a fundamental drive that we have also. And so you might think that someone like Hobbes, and maybe some Americans or the way that we talk about politics encourages this idea, the thought that we ignore the fact that each of us actually cares, or has some sort of a drive, to live with others in a way that acknowledges their point of view, their existence, and their interests. And so part of the reason why you might form a social contract is not just to benefit yourself, but to make sure that the political regime really is giving everybody what they are owed.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Our topic today, the social contract. Do you feel bound by one? If so, how would you define it? My guests are Rob Glover, Associate Professor of Political Science and Honors and co-leader of the Scholars Strategy Network Maine Chapter at the University of Maine. Lydia Moland is Professor of Philosophy at Colby College and the author of Lydia Mariah Child, A Radical American Life. And Paul Schofield is an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Bates College, and who last October wrote an opinion piece for the Washington Post titled, "Liberals Shouldn't Scoff at People's Fears of Homelessness and Crime." We have a link to it on our website. Join the conversation. Email us at talk@mainpublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We're joined on the phone now by Harald Bredesen. He's program director with GrowSmart Maine and is originally from Norway. Harald, hyggelig hilsepodai.
Hi, nice to meet you too.
Bare litt norsk. Yeah, I snakker bare litt norsk. I'm learning. I'm learning a language. I'm of Norwegian heritage, and finally, learning the language. How would you compare what you've witnessed of the American view of individual and societal rights and obligations to those in Norway?
I think I maybe have an example from, I moved to the U.S. in 2010. And at the time when I first moved here, I lived in New York. And I remember when Hurricane Sandy hit in 2012, and the neighborhood where I was living was severely flooded, a lot of damage. And I remember, I was lucky enough to live on the second floor. But I remember kind of looking out the window and expecting to see, government trucks and people in West and official looking cars. But instead I saw, people on bikes carrying food, people setting up tables with coffee, people bringing in pumps, for example, from their garage and bringing it to this neighborhood to kind of help the community. And I think that was, in Norway, it would have been, people would have considered that, like, this is the role of the government, this is why we pay taxes, and this is kind of what we consider, and they would perhaps not, I don't think they would, kind of take that kind of personal responsibility, which you do in the U.S., and I think that's, for various reasons that you've already kind of discussed, but for me, that's kind of the biggest difference, that there's limited government in some areas, but in Norway they would be more active. And at the same time, there are kind of this local initiative and communities taking on a lot of those, providing a lot of those services and doing a lot of those tasks.
Mm. I was, in the course of learning the language, one thing that struck me is that there are a couple of words, maybe more, that are distinctly Norwegian. They have no English equivalent, but one of them is "janteloven," which sort of means, I guess, you're not to think that you're anything special.
Yes.
And "dugnad," which is people getting together to fix things without getting paid.
So I would say, Yeah, if you talk about differences and similarities, so I work for Grow Smart Maine, and what we do is we support communities and we work with municipalities, local government to kind of solve problems or issues in communities. And very often, you know, if you see people on a select board, they are volunteers, right? And maybe they'll get a symbolic sum for serving on the select board. Maybe they're on a committee or a local planning board or something like that. And that is really the meaning of the word dugnad. It's about kind of volunteering and putting, let's say, the common good or the public good ahead of your immediate interest to maybe, I don't know, watch Netflix. But so that's kind of the word dugnad. And the Janteloven is, as you said, is very different in the sense that in Norway you are supposed to kind of keep your head down. You're not supposed to, you know, think you're special. We're all the same, and that's very different in the U.S. where there's this the culture of individualism and kind of being visible So that's very. There's a cultural difference there, and of course, Norway is a much more kind of egalitarian society in that sense. So, as well, yeah.
And you do point out that you see examples, however, of obviously in this country, people volunteering mm-hmm. and helping, and in fact, you're president of Neighbors Driving Neighbors, which is a group that it sounded sort of self-explanatory. But talk a little bit about that and why. You feel so strongly about it.
Well, moving to Maine and getting engaged, making a home here. One of the things that I do is like volunteer for this organization that provides volunteer rides for people. We serve about six towns here in central Maine. And it was a way for me to meet my neighbors, and it was a way I liked driving, so, I get to know the area. So it's a really meaningful way. And I'm now also serving on the board and as the president. And I think it's, for me, it's been like, in Norway, probably there would be some kind of a government-funded service that would provide this, but I kind of really like the fact that, these volunteers step up and they don't do it for any kind of financial incentive. They just do it because, they care about their community and they care about making a difference. And it's very meaningful, and it gives people, I think, agency in shaping their community and being a part of their community. And I think that's a really good thing about home rule and about here in Maine and the towns here in Maine.
Yeah. Harald Bredesen, Program Director with Grow Smart Maine. Ha det, og takk for i dag.
Takk skal du ha. Takk.
I'll go to the panel. It was just interesting that a country like Norway, culturally, is just steeped in the idea that we are, no one is in particular better than anyone else. And there's almost a tacit, if not outspoken, understanding that you will help, you will volunteer, you will help for the, and there's a sense of the good of the all. Obviously, every country has a, different variation of that. And I guess I'm just wondering, how does America sit in there? What is your view as compared to what you just heard Harald talk about? How would you describe what we're doing here in the U.S.? Lydia, I'll let you go first.
Yes, I'll just jump in as yet another Norwegian American on this call to say that I think like the question that you're raising specifically about political identity and the way people's political identities and national identities can form and motivate their actions. I want to tie that back to something that Paul said, which is that I think we cede too much to Hobbes if we assume that what people are generally doing is just fighting for their self-interest. That precipitates a kind of story that continues, but it's not in line with our national values. Again, if we think about these inalienable rights that we have, that doesn't mean that we pursue them without thinking about others. And I think being motivated by national ideals is a really powerful thing that we can lean into without ceding that ground to Hobbes. And we can instead say these very American values that we have don't have to be predicated only to the individual, but it can involve the kinds of things that Harold was talking about, or the kinds of things that can build consensus rather than tear it down.
Yeah, I think that one way of understanding what's going on with our politics at the moment is a kind of move away from commitment to the kinds of values that are at the heart of social contract theory. So if you look at what's going on in Congress, a lot of the times there's a focus on winning for your particular side at all costs, violating whatever norm you can violate in order to get your own way. And there's a lot of hand-wringing about, like, well, where have, you know, where you know, what about like what has gone wrong here, right? And I think part of what it is that people want is a system where we're not just duking it out with one another, but one in which we're thinking about the other side and what could possibly be justified to them. That doesn't mean that you always get your way or that you always cede to the other side, but it's very different to view politics from the point of view of, well, this is just a nonviolent way of trying to get what it is that I want or to win, and thinking of politics as an attempt to arrive at some sort of agreement or result that reasonable sides could agree upon, even though they have different values.
So it's almost as if this winning has become the central focus of politics. Politicians are focused on getting reelected, isn't it really at the feet, though, of the voters who are agreeing to reward them for refusing to solve problems in the interest of simply, stirring emotions in order to win for the team? It still comes down to the people, I guess, is what I'm asking. Rob?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I would say that we can't put too much blame on the voters, because I think a lot of voters probably feel as if they don't have effective options to make choices about people who don't engage in that sort of cynical game. And that's certainly true at the federal level. And I think it's reflected in people's attitudes about government in general, like the federal government, the United States government. We've seen trust in government decline from a high point in the late 1950s of about 80% trust to now lower than 20%. And I think if you really want to understand people's affiliation and belonging, and this, many of the comments that we've had over the last few minutes make me think of this, you need to look more locally than that. And Maine is a great example, right? Where, like, the feelings of connection and the willingness to engage in self-sacrifice and the concerns that people have for one another, if we really want to understand that, we should look more locally, and we can look to the state of Maine and see elements that really resonate with what Rousseau was talking about, this kind of like perspective taking and not just operating on the basis of self-interest, but thinking about others. And when we dive down below Maine and we look at individual Maine communities, we see this as well. That's not to say that we're not polarized, that we're not divided. But in a lot of ways, I think the communal level, those ideas are still operative. And that aligns too with what Rousseau said about, like, setting up governments. He never would have created something as large as the United States. He simply didn't think that that level of connection and commonality and shared fate was possible in a country as large and complex as the United States. But I do think at the community level, we see, just extraordinary self-sacrifice and feelings of community and belonging that we don't necessarily feel at the federal level.
I want to get at this as we maybe take up the issue of homelessness that we've been experiencing here in Maine, the debate around that, localize that a little bit. And I also want to take some calls, but we're going to take a quick break here. The phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, we're discussing the idea of a social contract. What do we, or what don't we, owe to our fellow citizens? My guests all teach some aspect of this question. Rob Glover is at the University of Maine, Paul Schofield is at Bates College, and Lydia Moland is at Colby College. Share your questions, comments, email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Torbert in York. Hi, Torbert. Welcome.
Good morning, Keith and guest. I would like to observe that all the philosophers spoken of today are coming out of a Western European Caucasian tradition that was preceded by hundreds and hundreds of years of endless war and the beginnings of the world imperialism scheme we see today running the world. In opposition to that is the American indigenous perspective that the earth itself is a brother and a sister of a familial entity not to be exploited. And also the basketball Celtics brought to light the Ubuntu African concept that everyone is in it together, all for one, one for all. And these two perspectives outside the Western Caucasian tradition.
Yeah, Torbert, thank you. Acknowledged that this we are talking about English thinkers of several hundred years ago. Yeah, Lydia.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. I think it's a really important reminder. And also, if we phrase this question too narrowly, what do we owe to each other? That can be very narrow if we think about just people like us. And it can also be too narrow if we think only of humans. So if we don't think about what we owe the animal kingdom and the natural world, then I agree, we are definitely limiting ourselves. And I also just want to say that the social contract tradition has been used by non-white people to try to critique the very circumstances that they're in, including, you know, in philosophy, people like Charles Mills, who wrote a book called The Racial Contract, and Carol Pateman, who wrote something called The Sexual Contract, both of which are trying to use that philosophical framework to critique the way in which it tends to be very European centered. And the other thing I just want to point out is that in the Black tradition in the United States, people have used this kind of language to talk about what is owed. So you can think about Martin Luther King talking about that America has given Black Americans a bad check that has come back marked insufficient funds. And that's a very clear sense that America has not upheld its part of the social contract vis-a-vis Black Americans. And you can also think of Malcolm X going back to to Thomas Hobbes, even the tradition, and saying if the end of obedience is protection and Black Americans are not being protected by the government, going back through lynching and Jim Crow laws, et cetera, then the obligation to obey the government is also compromised. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and say that it is also tradition that has been used to critique itself, as it were.
Yeah, Paul?
Yeah, the caller mentioned Ubuntu, which is the African idea that we're sort of made ourselves by virtue of the fact that we are one among many people. I'm not just an individual that exists alone. I'm part of humanity. I think that there's some connection between that and Rousseau's idea of the general will. With respect to Rousseau, his thought isn't that, well, the general will is kind of out there and the collective kind of imposes it upon me. Rather, his idea is that each of us has a bit of the general will inside of us, so that we do actually have this drive to act in the interest of humanity. And that's part of what it is to be a human being. It's part of our nature that we strive toward that. And so I think I think it's possible to look at the social contract tradition as if it's overly individualistic, but I think there are strains of it at least that really are comparable to other traditions that don't seem so individualistic.
Yeah, I did mention before the break, Paul, you had written about homelessness. I think you had an opinion piece in the Washington Post in the fall, headlined "Liberals Shouldn't Scoff at People's Fears of Homelessness." What were you getting at in that piece? What sort of prompted it?
Well, in that particular piece, I was concerned a bit that in their rush to advocate for people who are unhoused, who are among the least advantaged members of our society, liberals were in some cases beginning to ignore the legitimate complaints that others might have about, for instance, unhoused people taking up public spaces. Now, that doesn't mean I think they should be cleared out or anything like that, but I was encouraging the audience to think about, well, what if you were somebody who was housed but weren't necessarily a high income resident of a neighborhood, and so you need the park in order to bring your kids there. What would you say to that person who's complaining about, the fact that they can no longer use the park? And so my thought was that a lot of these discussions had sort of everybody had taken their side and was no longer thinking about the reasonable complaints that might be made on the other side. And I think that I was trying to make a progressive case for taking seriously those sorts of complaints. And I think it really was a sort of social contract idea behind it. The thought is, don't just pick your side, also speak to the concerns of others when they are reasonable.
And so the problem with that is what, and we've already discussed this, is there's no political capital to be gained, right? If you're just out there being reasonable, solving problems, you don't get elected, you don't get into power. And that just seems to me is that the real puzzle that we have in trying to break away from the polarity that we're gripped in now, do you think? Rob, I'll let you go.
Sure. I mean, I guess the issue with electoral politics is that many of the problems that we face, right? Like, take the contemporary housing crisis, and let's just focus here in Maine. That has been in the works for a long time, and any sort of meaningful solutions to that issue will take a long time to develop and implement. And our next several decades will be addressing just the crisis as we face it right now. And the system that we've created, while well-meaning, right, representative democracy in which people are constituents of elected leaders, can incentivize shorter-term solutions. So I think you're onto something in the sense that, like, political capital in the system that we've created with the institutions that we currently have does not necessarily lend itself to the sorts of big picture thinking that would be required for the terms of the social contract to be equitably enjoyed by all members of society. I think there's a lot of people right now who feel as if there is a social contract, its benefits are distributed unequally, and they are not enjoying, if we just take Locke's conception, right, their lives, liberty, and property are not respected and protected in the same way that other individuals are. And that too, I think, is like one of our major political challenges right now in the United States, is how do we work to ensure that more people feel as if the social contract protects them and is truly something that protects us as a society, as opposed to a certain set of elite individuals.
Lydia, this question of what we owe each other was the I guess the topic of the NBC sitcom The Good Place. You had a conversation with Michael Schur, who's the creator of The Good Place. Can you tell us about that and what you what you got from it?
Yeah, this was, I'll never forget the first time someone said to me, look, there's a sitcom on NBC about moral philosophy. And I said, no, there's not. But it turns out there is, or there was. And yeah, this was inspired. So Michael Schur, the creator, came across Tim Scanlon's book, What We Owe to Each Other, and was so fascinated by this idea of that as a starting point, that we don't have to justify that we owe anything to each other, but that, and this goes back to something that Paul said earlier too, we are the kinds of creatures who want to give each other reasons for our behavior. We want to be able to justify ourselves and to live lives of integrity. And so he imagined what it would be like to try to set up a sitcom in which there were a group of people who were always inclined for various reasons to pursue their own self-interest and throw each other under the bus, but who would find in the kind of created meaning of relationships reasons not to be that way. So I wouldn't, at no point in The Good Place do they sign a social contract, but there's one that develops essentially out of this shared humanness. And he describes like thinking about this as a kind of radical realization on his part that there could be a way of really talking about a moral structure that doesn't, again, cede too much to Hobbes and assume that everyone is going to be at each other's throats at a moment's notice, but that we can actually build meaning amongst ourselves as humans by saying, again, to go back to Rousseau, yes, we live in a polarized society that has all kinds of corruption and antagonism, but that's a society that we've created. And we can, since we've created it, we can change it. And I think that's another thing that is the kind of existential side of that sitcom, The Good Place, that there's something terrifying about that responsibility, that this is not just something that naturally happened. It's something that we created, and that means we have a responsibility to change it if we think that we need to. The real miracle about that sitcom is it managed to make that point and also be pretty funny a lot of the time.
Yeah, Paul?
Yeah, I would also say, like, I sometimes think that we're a little too pessimistic about people's ability to reason with one another reasonably, as you say. I've found through my work on homelessness that if you jump on social media and say something, say something controversial or outlandish, then you're very likely to just get into a fight with a lot of people. But if you develop relationships and sit down with people who disagree with you, I think that you really will find that many people do want their views to land with you, and they do want to listen to what it is that you have to say. And I found this quite a bit with homelessness. It's an issue that can be very divisive, but once I get talking with people, I find that we both have a lot of common ground and that they actually want to have a reasonable position on the matter. Sometimes it looks hopeless if we look at what's going on in, Congress at the moment. But I do think, we can see the rudiments of something better in the way that we interact with our fellow citizens, even when we disagree with them.
Email from Elizabeth. I have taught my children that to be a true part of your community, especially in a small town, you need to know the value of and practice building social capital. There is a great value in spending a few moments chatting with your local mechanic, a town employee, or simply complimenting a stranger at the grocery store on their shoes or their hat, etc. Both parties gain a nice sense of well-being from the encounter, and it costs nothing. I have just about a minute left, but I just want to, maybe one of you could answer this. You're teaching, obviously, young students in this realm. Is there anything that strikes you that do they have a different view of social contract theory? Do they have a different idea than maybe of our previous generations? Anything that you've noted from the classroom, Rob?
Yeah, well, I think for a lot of us, when we think about contracts, we tend to view them sort of instrumentally and transactionally, right? And so we think of things like our mortgage or our car loan. And, that's one type of contract. And I don't think, as the conversation has suggested, I don't think that's the best model to think about. And there's other forms of contracts that are a bit more demanding and interesting than that. So like marriage, for example, right, is a contract. And I think increasingly with our students, particularly coming out of the pandemic and responding to the isolation they felt in those moments, they're doing really interesting things with building connection online and in real life spaces and kind of hybrid spaces, and supporting one another, mutual aid, caring for one another, attending to each other's mental health, and making sure that they feel connected and they feel supported. So I think the kids are all right. and I think they probably define the social contract in more expansive ways than we might.
All right. And with that, we're out of time. Appreciate all of you being here today. Very interesting conversation. Lydia Moland, professor of philosophy at Colby College and author of Lydia Mariah Child, A Radical American Life. Paul Schofield, professor of philosophy at Bates College, and Rob Glover, professor of political science at the University of Maine. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Our music theme music was composed by Mike Gendro. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. Visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or listen to past programs. If you sign up now, you'll be entered to win one of our mystery book bundles. And if you're looking for another way to connect with us, download the Maine Public Vox Pop app. It's a quick and easy way to get a voice message to us. Search Maine Public Vox Pop, VOXPOP, wherever you get your smartphone apps. I'm Keith Shortall. This is Maine Calling.